Jack Spierka with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today on episode 62 of Friday Flashbacks, we're flashing back to what was originally episode 771, Ben Falk on growing rice in cold climates with permaculture. This was originally recorded on October the 24th, 2011. Couple things about this episode before I drop you into it. There's two things I had never heard of prior to this episode, or prior to the guest application for this episode. One was a Ben Falk. I didn't know what or who a Ben Falk was. Ben Falk, of course, is part of our expert council. He's been on the show many times, but this was his first appearance with us. And I realized right away that we had, you know, a brother regenerative ag slash permaculture warrior in Ben. A really smart guy with really smart design and really good at figuring out how to build resiliency into life. I later actually was able to go speak at one of his PDCs and see his place, and it was absolutely amazing what he did with a place that, you know, when he bought it 10 years earlier, barely could grow grass. It's just an amazing cold climate permaculture design that he has in Vermont. The other thing I had never heard of was growing rice in cold climates. In my head, rice was absolutely kind of a tropical, at least warm weather crop. And if you look at where we grow it heavily in the United States, you're talking about Louisiana and Alabama. You're not talking about, you know, Minnesota or South Dakota. Ben being in Vermont, it's USDA Zone 4, developed a hillside agriculture system with rice as a keystone crop in it. And I was blown away. I'm not a big rice eater. Even back then, I wasn't. But the fact that you could do it and the way that it would actually improve fertility over time absolutely floored me. And I realized you could actually sub in other grains. If we look at Masanobu Fukuoka, for instance, he was doing things like barley behind rice. Well, you could do barley in this type of a system. You just wouldn't flood the paddy while it was growing. Really interesting, or in a rotation, rice one year, barley the next year, etc. And that might actually work really well. I'm not sure exactly how you would time that in a climate like Ben's. I haven't worked in a climate like that in a very long time because I don't like when my face hurts. But there's definitely something to that. And it might actually be a better way for some people to go as you listen to this. Think about what you could sub into this, because Ben has said many times to me that the narrow point, right, the congestion point in that whole process is the rice seedlings. You can't direct seed in that climate. There's not enough time to get a full crop. And you can listen to him outline it now. And again, here we go, flashing back to October of 2011, episode 771, Ben Falk on growing rice in cold climates with permaculture. And with that wrapped up, let's go ahead and get into the main topic of today's show. All right, folks, as I said during the introduction segment, we are fortunate to have with us today Mr. Ben Falk. Ben is a farm planner and a homestead developer for folks, you know, getting ready up for transition in Vermont. He's also personally a homesteader. He focuses on developing systems to help him and his family be resilient to changing times. This requires a lot of R&D on new crops and cropping systems.
And he takes best strategies from all over the world in similar climates and applies them to his area up there again in Vermont. He's here today to talk to us about a variety of things. We're going to start out talking about growing rice in cold climates, which I think is something most people don't think you can do. So this should be a great episode. Hey, Ben, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Ben, I wanted to start out with something real simple. You know, why rice in the first place? And I mean, can you actually grow rice in Vermont? I mean, everybody thinks of like Southeast Asia and rice paddies and the heat and everything. Why rice and why in Vermont?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, since I started studying agriculture in college, had always seen, you know, incredible photos that most people are probably aware of these, you know, endlessly terraced hillsides, mostly in Southeast Asia is where we see these photos of these amazing, you know, centuries and sometimes millennia old agricultural systems that have been sustainable for thousands of years in places, but mostly in the subtropics of Asia. And I guess over the last 3 or 4 years just started to see some photos of these systems from northern Japan. And the more we started working with our own research and development farm here in central Vermont, the more we started to pay attention to water and how water moves across the landscape, and really with an emphasis of across the landscape and not enough of the time into the landscape. And so I started to become more and more interested in anything, any type of structure that can slow, spread, and sink water. And infiltrate water, not lose the value that water has by letting it, you know, run off of our sloping sites. Mostly, in Vermont is almost all sloping land, sometimes steeply sloping. So, I guess about 3 or 4 years ago, I saw a photo of rice paddies covered in snow, and it was from Hokkaido in northern Japan. And I guess the light bulb just went off for me. Made me realize, wow, you know, you can definitely, there are these systems in cold climates, very cold climates, and knew enough about northern Japan to know it's at least as cold as it is here in the mountains of Vermont, and the growing season is just as short, even more importantly. So, you know, some of our earthworks that we had started to do here, mostly around swales and ponds, you know, naturally led us into paddies as a third form of earthworks. And rice as a crop, really I think is important, very important on several fronts, but especially the fact that it's a small grain that we can grow here on marginal, you know, kind of non-agricultural land. You know, most of Vermont and most of New England really, and increasingly most of the world is not, you know, fertile, deep, well-drained, loamy soil, which is most suited to most grains. And rice is this one grain, very unique grain that can be grown on not just marginal soil. There's a few grains that can tolerate poor soil, but is a grain that can be grown in inundated conditions, you know, flooded, totally tolerate flooding, no problem. And that allows us to bring nutrients into the system via gravity and perpetually in such a way that, you know, you can actually have a sustainable rice culture for hundreds and actually thousands of years because of the nutrient delivery system being in the form of water. And it's really quite amazingly simple when you think about it. You know, we don't have any examples of growing a terrestrial grain for more than a few hundred years without destroying a landscape. You know, the Midwestern United States, we've managed to pretty quickly lose most of the fertility there with grain systems in pretty short order. The whole, what used to be the Fertile Crescent was overweeded and is now a desert, due to poor grain agriculture. We have to, you know, get the fertility back into a terrestrial grain field mechanically. It requires a lot of effort. You know, right now we do it with fossil fuels and we do it at great expense with heavy equipment and we beat up our soil every time we do it. And it requires a lot of bare soil, which we know is a problem to maintain, fertility in bare soil agriculture. And here's this one grain, rice, that people have figured out can grow in the fertility of water. And to bring the fertility back into the landscape by gravity feeding water it's very easy to do. There's actually plenty of fertility around in most of our homesteads and farms. The challenge is moving it around without destroying the place very quickly.
Well, and moving it around without washing it away either. And, I mean, it basically sounds like you're following the first rule of permaculture irrigation, which is all water should take the longest, slowest path off a piece of property possible. The slower we can make it go, the more we can make it do work for us. And if we have nutrient that can break down in water, it's going to break down rather rapidly, and it's going to stay put.
Absolutely. And, you know, I like to think of rice and patties as really just edible stormwater detention basins. And, you know, we know it's very clear we need to detain our stormwater and slow it down before it moves through our landscape and hits our rivers and just causes a lot of destruction. And here's a way we can actually do that same service and get a yield out of it, you know, get a food yield in the process.
Well, you've been doing this 3 years, and it's kind of uncharted territory, at least for you. I've never heard of Vermont brand rice before. Maybe there is, but I haven't heard of it. So over those 3 years, have you learned anything unique or different or that you didn't expect?
Yeah, we certainly have. And it's, I should mention right off the bat, there are several folks, well, there's more, especially every year now, grown rice in Vermont, but there's a guy in Western Massachusetts who's been growing upland rice for quite a while, maybe about 15 years, who started the South River Miso Company. And then some folks who run a CSA out of near Putney, Vermont, the Akiogis, who started paddy rice, I think about 5 years ago, and they have a bottomland rice situation. And then as far as I know, we're the first folks who are really growing rice in a terraced paddy hillside situation. So we started that. This is our second full season in that. We grew our first season. It's our third season total. Our first season was in buckets to grow our seed crop that we needed. We didn't eat any of that first crop because we needed to produce the amount of seed we needed to have enough to plant the paddies. And you can grow rice really well in just 5 gallon buckets.
Can you give me an idea of what your seed yield is off of that? Let's say I had 10 5 gallon buckets. What kind of a yield am I going to get for seed crop?
Oh yeah. Well, you get, you know, one rice grain can give you a full rice plant, which can give you at least a few hundred more rice grains. So then you can make a few hundred plants from that one grain, and then those few hundred plants give you another few hundred seeds each. So, you know, you can run the math. It's like a factorial, and very quickly, you know, in 2 or 3 years, you could plant acres and acres and acres of rice.
All right, what I'm actually asking, though, is, like, you know, if I have one bucket, how many plants can I put in there, and, you know, how much seed do I get out per bucket?
Yeah, you can get 2 to 3 to 4 plants in a bucket, and each of those plants will make a few hundred seeds of rice. And so I would say, you know, we have about 1,000 square feet of rice paddy total between two paddies, and we easily could have gotten enough seed for those two patties from probably about 7 or 8 buckets worth of rice. And the amount of rice we can grow in those two patties is really about a year's supply. That's pretty much how we define what size we should make the patties. It's probably 125 to 150 pounds of rice we can get out of both our patties total once we get good at growing rice, which we're certainly still in the process of doing.
It sounds like there's some interesting opportunity for sustainability there too then, because any crop can have a year where we have a crop failure, but if I'm growing my seed crop for next year with something like a bucket system, I have a lot more potential to save my seed crop even if something catastrophic happens and I lose my main crop.
Absolutely, yeah, it's great to, you know, even when we're done planting our patties, I'll take some extra seedlings that I've started and throw them in some buckets right outside my shop. You know, outside the kitchen, I'll throw them in a bucket and put it in the pond, you know, just below the pond surface level so it won't ever run dry. I can't forget to water it. So say, yeah, my sheep or, you know, a bear crashes through my patties and destroys all the plants, I've got at least a seed crop growing in the background. Absolutely.
That's really cool. It's something I really had never thought of. I mean, I've just never grown rice. I'm not a huge rice eater myself. So I don't think about it, I guess, as much as I should, but that's a really cool sustainability, functionality. You mentioned you're kind of like the first one to do this on like a hillside agriculture in Vermont. kind of what do you see for like the future of rice growing with hillside agriculture? What do you think maybe that should look like or can look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, we have a fantastic example in terraced paddy agricultural systems that have emerged across mostly Asia for the last few thousand years. So that is one of the most advanced agricultural systems that the world's already ever come up with, I think, to begin with. So it's a good starting point for us in, you know, mountainous, hilly areas, in general, you know, to begin with. How can we improve on those systems? I think there's probably many ways, but these systems have gotten very advanced, even as they stand, in how they've been done throughout the world. People have done rice production in synergy with eels and fish and ducks, just to name a few other species in terms of how these systems are integrated and high functioning and kind of, you know, multi-yielding throughout the world. We're working with ducks as well. We're not working with fish directly yet in our rice systems or eels, but our ducks, which we've raised for about 3 years now, provide more than enough fertility to feed the rice, just from their habit of basically, you know, crapping in water, which we allow them to do. We allow them to access small pools of water uphill of the rice paddies, and then we siphon water, gravity feed water from those pools into the rice paddies to basically fertilize and irrigate the rice at once. So the water is performing two crucial functions. It's weed suppression. The rice doesn't need the water actually to grow, but it can tolerate it, whereas most of the weeds that we compete with it can't. And the other major function, just as important, is nutrient delivery. So in that water, we can get the rice all of the nutrients, macro and micronutrients it needs, especially nitrogen. So if you think about it, it's really a lot like hydroponics. We're growing our rice crop, you know, very dense staple crop, heavy feeder grass, in totally poor subsoil, you know, very, very poor subsoil. This is not topsoil that we're growing this in. And for us, this is why I'm so excited about it as a model for degraded lands agriculture, because the fertility that the plant is really growing in, it comes in the water. And it's easy to find fertile water. We have, you know, too much of it in the world washing into our oceans and our rivers. And in a paddy type of system, essentially you've got a hydroponic situation where the rice is growing in the water, and the substrate can be very, very poor subsoil.
It's almost more of an aquaponic situation, because you're involving other animals. Like in your case, ducks are in Southeast Asia. They involve fish and eels and stuff like that. I remember listening to a lecture by Bill Mollison where he said that over in Asia they almost have no mosquito problems in these areas. And you think there'd be mosquitoes everywhere, and it's because they're fish people and they put fish in everything. If he said, right, if it's a teacup size depression that holds water, they'll stick a minnow in there, and then, you know, a year later the minnow's a bigger minnow and they'll eat it. And because of all the fish involved and integrated in these systems, you get the fertility, but you also get, you know, they're mosquito predators. If there's enough fish in a body of water, you're going to have very little mosquito problem.
Absolutely. People, we do a lot of tours here, and people always see we're holding water all over the landscape in paddies and ponds and pools and swales. And they always say, how's it not buggy here? Because it's not very buggy here at all. And, you know, I said, well, it has not gotten any buggier from all the water holding we've been doing. And I think because, like you're saying, the whole ecosystem is participating in this water holding. So there's many, you know, hundreds of frogs now that there weren't, salamanders and toads and fish. So the, you know, everything's feeding on everything. So the bugs maybe are getting produced, or at least the larvae, but they're not getting much beyond that stage as far as we can tell, because they're getting eaten by everything else.
Yeah, I guarantee you in the Northeast woods, if you have that much water, you've attracted every frog and toad for 50 million acres around to that area. You've got a tremendous predator habitat there. Something I really hadn't thought about. So you're working with ducks, but I was going to ask you, well, how do you keep the ducks from eating the rice? So basically the ducks don't have access to the rice paddies. They have access to like maybe like a Key Point Dam or smaller dams above, and then you're filtering the waste and nutrient down into the paddies.
Exactly. That's how we've done it so far, but our next step is to actually integrate the ducks physically into the paddies. What folks have figured out probably thousands of years ago is something really amazing, and probably, you know, it actually is not coincidental. Maybe it was even part of the breeding process over thousands of years of rice. Rice has too high of a silica content for ducks to digest the material. And ducks don't want to eat rice. They want to eat basically everything else in the patty.
Oh, awesome.
Synergy, it's really amazing. The synergy between just the speed, you know, the organism that is a duck and the organism that is in rice goes way back. And because of that silica content, you have this incredible situation where this animal will go through the patty and very carefully and nimbly, you know, ducks that really are amazing at their lack of disturbance of plants, you know, with their webbed feet, they'll walk through the patty weeding out everything else but the rice. Now, you don't want them in there once the seed head is on, because then they'll definitely go for the plant.
So basically, it's to control their access. You give them access free range until you're starting to put seed heads on, and then we move them off, or maybe it's time for some of them to, you know, quote-unquote graduate into a protein source. But that was my kind of my next question on your ducks. Are you raising them for a meat yield, an egg yield, both, nutrient add? Or, I mean, what's the duck's final output here?
The first, really all of the above, the first motivating reason for getting them was reading in Elliot Coleman's book about slug control via Indian runner ducks. Because we have so much water holding going on and so much clover, which the slugs seem to love, we have had major slug problems in our vegetable gardens. So we got the ducks, they completely eliminated the slug problem, and then of course they also have an egg yielding, you know, capacity. So we get a lot of eggs. I get about 8 to 9 eggs from my ducks right now, and I have 10 ducks total. One's a male. So I get basically an egg a day from every duck. And then we'll, you know, when they get their end of their lifetime, they'll be eaten as well. But they're really, you know, they have a lot of meat on them. They're really, the meat yield is farther down the list.
Fairly low. So I mean, you're doing Indian runners then? And that's because my next question is, what breed are you working with?
Right. Well, originally we had Indian runners for 2 years and only Indian runners, and now I've been experimenting with Indian runners, khaki Campbells, Welsh Harlequins, and Gold Star hybrids. So I've got a few different, and you know, it's hard to tell what ducks are doing what, you know, without a video camera, I can't tell who's laying, really.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I can kind of watch them forage and see who's foraging. It seems like when you get a whole gang of ducks together, they all tend to act very similar, you know. So it's, I can't even say the difference between the breeds at this point just yet.
Well, very cool. So, I mean, I think this is really interesting to me. Can you kind of give me an idea what your yields are? You said you've got like 1,000 square feet under cultivation. What kind of a yield do you get out of that?
Yeah, so far we've, with our first season in the patty, which was last year, we got probably about 75 pounds of grain out of it. And then we're still actually processing that because I'm only de-hulling as I go to keep the grain fresh, and we can talk about the processing in a minute. And then this year I planted more densely. We're experimenting with not only the spacing of the plants, because that's something that no one's figured out in this climate. People have all sorts of recommendations around the world as to spacing, but of course this is probably the coldest part of certainly in this continent where anyone's been growing rice. And we're experimenting with spacings, but we're also experimenting with how we're fertilizing each patty. So we have two different patties. So, you know, I think we're very far from getting optimal yields. But right now I think it's safe to say we can envision getting the standard organic rice yield that people get in California and Arkansas, as far as I know, which is about 5,000 pounds an acre. So when we get that yield, we'll have about 125 pounds of rice being produced here every year.
That's pretty cool. I mean, it's not something you would generally think that you could do in a place like Vermont, but I've actually always kind of noticed that you see the terrace stuff, and you mentioned seeing in Japan, and I've seen in, you know, northern Vietnam, up in their cloud forests. I know it gets cold up there, so I think it's just in our minds it's become a tropical crop where it actually has a great deal of survivability in many different climates. What it needs is nutrient and water.
It does. And the fact that we can grow this crop in subsoil, to me, is a real game changer. I mean, it's a grain, it's a small grain, so it doesn't need a freezer, refrigerator, or even a root cellar to store it, and it stores for years. You know, not 1 year, not 2 year. You know, you can put up rice in the right conditions, put away for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. So that piece from just a baseline survival standpoint you know, it's really hard to beat grain. Now, as from a permaculture standpoint, which is my background, you know, we get a little down on grain. But rice kind of changes all that. You know, I wasn't even looking into grain for a while because, you know, we're really a perennial cropping basis, as we see the most resilient systems as having a perennial basis, and this is an annual crop. But the fact that it can utilize all of these excess nutrients in the form of water and produce a crop that stores for years, you know, changes all that to me, and seems like a crucial crop to grow, at least at the homestead scale.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, because I'm, you know, first and foremost, very much into the world of permaculture and as much sustainability as I can create. And then from a long-term sustainability of the land and a yield. But I'm also very much of a paleo person, so I'm not real big into starches and carbohydrates. But
right.
To ignore the survival value of something like a storable crop like rice would just be foolish, because the whole point of sustainability and survivability is you don't always get to pick what's for dinner tomorrow, but it'd be nice if there was something there.
Exactly. It's really hard to... I think dry beans is the only thing else I would put in the category of rice, and maybe live animals as far as,
yep.
You know, a solid yield you can depend on, a bomb-proof yield, no matter what the climate throws at us, you know, year to year. I mean, I think about 1816, year without a summer, you know, is kind of a good reference point to design around, you know, to forget anything humans have been messing around with climate-wise. That was just a bunch of volcanoes going off in 1815 around the world, and there was a hard frost every month of the year across a lot of the United States, and people died in snowstorms in July in Vermont.
Yep.
You know, complete crop failure. And, you know, really, you need 2 years of the food stored up at that point. You know, just having 1 year, it wouldn't cut it. So grain, you know, it's hard to imagine what crops can do that for us. It seems like grains, dry beans, as far as storability and live animals, you know, with hay in the barn.
Yeah, especially smaller live animals where you can just slaughter as much as you need for today, like, you know, rabbits, chickens,
right.
Ducks, and things like that. Oh, well, real quick before we move on, I want to talk to you about some of the permaculture design stuff you do. But you mentioned the ducks and the eggs, and you're not sure who's laying. How exactly are you managing them? I mean, like, I'm real familiar with managing chickens for eggs. And, you know, with chickens for eggs, you have a chicken house, and the chickens go in there, and you just go by and pick them up like shopping every morning. How are you managing your ducks? Where are they housed at night? Where are they laying for you? Because the little bit of duck keeping I did, we kind of just left them to themselves, and one day out comes mom with 20 peeps, and that's not the way to do it if you want egg production.
Right, right. We've always had good luck with providing a nice, safe place for them to go into at night, and they just seem to get in the habit of going in to what's now, it's been different things at different times for us. Right now it's basically the paddock, it's the barn where we keep our sheep in the winter. And they just have nests right on the ground in there. They want to come in every night at dusk. They're waiting to come in. We give them sometimes a little grain, you know, in the summer even just to get them started on that habit. And then we won't feed them grain at all for most of the warm season. We'll start again around now. And then every morning I go out and collect, you know, right now I'll collect 8-9 eggs every morning. That they just lay on the ground there in their nest. And then they'll be in there. They free range. So they're free ranging all day, all around, but they always want to come back at night.
Well, that's part of why you have a low meat yield then, because you're making them do work versus raising them as a direct crop.
Absolutely. And their free ranging here is so valuable just to the land. You know, even if I didn't get any eggs from them, it'd really be worth it to have the amount of fertility they're spreading across this landscape. They're basically turning, you know, slugs and snails, which we have an abundance of here in this super humid climate, into fertilizer, into soil, plant growth by, you know, manuring the property, and then into eggs as well.
Yeah, it's another Mollison statement that I'll never forget. I heard him say one time, he said, there's two things that people have think they have a surplus of that they never have a surplus of. One is slugs and the other is grasshoppers. He said there's no such thing as a slug problem. You have a duck deficiency. And there's no such thing as a grasshopper problem. You have a turkey deficiency. That either one of them can be turned into a yield and to a nutrient source. So really cool stuff. So on that note, you are a permaculturist. Yourself, you don't just do rice, you do full system design. You have clients that you do design work. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about that segment of what you're actually doing there beyond just your own piece of property or even what you've been doing
Sure.
there that you're expanding into other people's areas?
Absolutely, yeah. So the rice is just one part of us you know, working with our homestead for very personal reasons, to, you know, kind of address the question, well, how can we bring back the health of this very degraded landscape while to do ecosystem restoration while simultaneously feeding ourselves, fueling ourselves, keeping ourselves healthy? You know, how can we grow as much food as possible, fuel wood, for, you know, heating, firewood, and medicine, you know, potent food medicine crops from as small of an area as possible, you know, with as few inputs as possible from off-site. So just essentially regenerative agriculture and all the homesteading systems, how can we do that as effectively as possible? So then we end up, people end up connecting with us who want to do that on their own land, which is an increasing amount of our population, fortunately, every year. It's still a very small market. But we have about 5 to 20 projects a year across mostly Vermont, but we also work as far south as New York City, and was up in Montreal a couple days ago giving a workshop. So generally New England area, helping folks find land, locate houses, you know, master planning questions. My backdrop is in landscape architecture and site planning. So locate a home on a piece of land, you know, an access road, you know, where to put a pond, where to put an orchard. So a lot of site planning work. And then we'll also help design specifics of that, like what species go where, what are the plant guilds, you know, where's the fencing, how's the pond design, how's the paddy design. We've actually done some rice paddy construction for clients who are really wanting to do some experimentation themselves. And then we'll implement a lot of those systems. We'll subcontract and build ponds. I'll do some heavy work myself with a compact excavator I run. We'll plant trees. We've planted between maybe 300 and 1,000, you know, edible perennials every year for the last handful of years. And then we'll do gravity feed water systems and some small buildings as well.
Here's a question I get a lot of times when people say to me, you know, they're going out to look at land or evaluate land. What is like the first four or five things that when you go to a raw piece of land and you're thinking about doing it, you're looking at? I mean, I'm looking at slope. I'm looking at solar angles. I'm looking at wind. You know, what are you looking for when you first go in?
Right. Well, all of those, you know, baseline analysis questions we ask, you know, what's the slope? What's the aspect? How long's the day? Is, you know, how heavy are the winds are here? What are the soils? What's the water? You know, where's the water table at? Digging holes is really underrated. I mean, if you can just dig a bunch of holes all over a property you're thinking about buying, you're going to learn more from doing that and watching those holes, ideally over a few seasons, but even just over a month, than you can through, you know, most other means of understanding the water and the soil, especially the water table. Where we are, the water table's at the surface over good parts of New England for good parts of the year, and that's, you know, can be an advantage, but it also can be a real disadvantage and be something that's challenging to work around. The other big piece is access. You know, there's a lot of, I go on a lot of site consults for people who walk me in from the main road, and we're walking up an old logging road and steep, and we're walking and walking and walking, and they finally, we get to a spot and they say, so this is where we're thinking of putting a house. Isn't this a great spot? And I say, well, you know what that road, you know what that's going to cost to put a road in so you can get your car up here? And they usually have no idea. So there's a lot of great sites that are great if it wasn't for needing to access them. So access is a whole other, you know, limiting factor, and there'd be, I think, often a site's not good because you can't get to it. But if you could, it'd be great. So access is a big piece that, you know, a lot of people put in roads that are going to be much more difficult and expensive to maintain than they realize, especially in this cold climate up here. We get a lot of ice and snow and heavy rain events, you know, constantly washing out roads.
I tell people a lot of times when you're looking at land online, and it looks like there's nothing wrong with it, but it's $550 an acre for a 20-acre spread, access is usually going to be an issue. It's probably your first question before you even go out and walk the place to the real estate agent or the seller. What kind of access does the land have?
Exactly. And I think 10% is a good magic number. If you can stay below 10% grade, you know, one in a rise of 1 foot in a run of 10 foot or less, I feel like in this climate at least, you can make that a pretty maintainable road. You can maintain ditches by hand. You can be in a situation where you're not dependent on dump truck loads of gravel from year to year, and you start getting above 10, 15% grade, and everything just tend to start washing away pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we have a lot of people that talk about going to a PDC, a permaculture design course. I know you do that as well. But kind of what I want to talk to you about, because you're also in the business of consulting, is what can a person, let's say a person, they're not hiring you to assess the land. They've already got a piece of land. They've got a house on it. It is what it is. And you know, maybe they, when they bought it, they weren't even, and most of us, when we buy our houses, we're not thinking about this stuff then. And then they realize, I've got some space, I've got some stuff to work with, maybe everything's not optimal. They start reading the design manual, maybe they even take a course, and they say to themselves, I'm going to need to bring someone that can maybe help me take this to the next level. What can a client of you, or probably any permaculture designer, expect in that experience of having, you know, land looked at and advice given and what have you?
Right. Well, I think, you know, having just an outside opinion of someone who works with land in the same climate you're working with by itself is invaluable. You know, even if they're not a permaculture designer or a landscape architect or, you know, someone who develops sites and understands how you go about putting roads in and buildings in a landscape and water systems. So that by itself, having a third-party view is very helpful because it's easy to miss really obvious things when it's your own site and you've been looking at it a lot, just like any project. But then from a, you know, kind of practitioner standpoint, I mean, my goal when I do a site visit is to basically help people avoid making mistakes and see low-hanging fruit, see opportunities that they're – identify challenges and opportunities. You know, the only way I can do that for people is because I'm working with my own land on a daily basis. You know, there's a lot of people out there reading different things in books and then trying to apply it kind of generically to sites, and you know, that it doesn't often work out very well. There's a lot of impracticalities to doing that. There's, you know, you can learn a lot from books, but you know, when you go make ponds and live with those ponds and see how they behave through a whole winter, and when the ice comes and, you know, see how snow falls off of buildings, you know, you start to understand how these systems really work. So we're trying to help people avoid mistakes that are easy to make. And those will range from siting a building poorly to just designing a driveway and how it connects with the building poorly, such that you have a giant pile of snow you can't get rid of in the winter without sitting there shoveling the whole thing, you know, an area the plow can't get to. Little things like that to, you know, avoiding putting an orchard in an area where it loses the late day sun 2 hours earlier than it should for really getting fruit to ripen. So sometimes it gets more specific. We'll do sunshade analysis to help avoid those mistakes. But usually with, you know, my site visits, they range between $100 and $300 most of the time. And I think it's safe to say most of the time they save people between $1,000 and $3,000. You know, it's not really that hard to do. When you're developing a site, you're going to spend a lot of money or a lot of time or both. And with someone who has experience doing similar projects like that in that climate, it's pretty easy to start saving big bucks and especially saving a lot of time and stress and, you know, not making mistakes that make the time frame of a project's development, you know, really stretch out because things are put in the wrong place or done in the wrong order.
Yeah, on that, I mean, I know every site's different because every place I've ever looked at has never been exactly the same as the one before it. But is there certain mistakes you see very commonly made that you know, like the big ones to stay out of the way of, or some real common dumb things that people do that don't seem dumb when they're doing them, but they end up having a dumb result?
Absolutely. It's a good question. I think siting buildings in the wrong place in the landscape is a big one, and that's kind of a type one error because then you're just working around that compromised situation for the rest of the project, you know, unless you go and move the building, which isn't usually done for good reason. So siting buildings improperly, it's really tricky to site, just to site a house, you know, just right. It can take a while, and it can take, even with experience, you can really have to visit a site a number of times across a number of seasons to get it just right. You know, at least you can get it pretty close if you have experience doing that and living with systems, multifunctional systems, in that same climate. Water, it probably is the other big thing. Oftentimes, you know, roads, the ditches on roads even are done poorly. Where water is sent, where it's harvested, and then where it's sent to on a site is, you know, usually sub-optimized. So from an agricultural standpoint, we're always working with key line agricultural principles and trying to bring water from the valleys to the ridges, which there's a whole a world to get into along those lines of why do that. But when you're making a pond, you know, you have to choose which side the outflow is. It's easy to get that wrong. I mean, I've done that wrong here on my own site enough times to make adjustments and you know, not make those same mistakes on client sites where we make ponds as well. Yeah, you know, how to infiltrate the water is a big challenge. I mean, most of the time the approach is just get rid of the water. Now, if it's someone that wants their land to be really productive, that's, you know, of course, kind of the opposite approach you want to take. You want to maximize the value from that water like we talked about in the beginning. And there's a lot of master planning questions about that, like where's the road and where's the culverts and the ditches and the ponds that actually end up affecting what happens with the water. Those are big ones. You know, there's many, many others. You know, where to clear land, you know, where to clear forest is a question that comes up a lot. And when to do it, the order of all these things is often also often not done, you know, in an optimal way. But I'd say water and, you know, locating buildings and major elements is often a good place where a lot of mistakes are done most, you know, quite often.
One of the things I get from a lot of people, Ben, are they've read, you know, the Permaculture One and the Permaculture Designer's Manual, and they watch all these videos and DVDs that Lawton and Mullison and the other folks do, and they really have a heavy focus in the developing world and in the tropics. So a lot of the plant varieties they plant are not suitable for temperate climates. But I believe, you know, this is a system that works anywhere. But what are some of your favorite, you know, species or plants that you're working with other than rice in that those perennial systems, you know, that can handle the winters in Vermont?
Yeah, great question. Well, I'm looking at some of them right now standing here on my porch. I think elderberry, Siberian seaberry. Elderberry people know of a lot, but Siberian seaberry is kind of a relatively new crop to this part of the globe. Korean bush cherry, and I can talk about any one of these, you know, if you're interested. Apple, of course, you know, apple I really think is our totem fruit. You know, that's like our coconut. You can't really in the northern climates avoid, you know, the hundreds of uses of what apple offers. And then a lot of other fruits, blueberries, you know, blueberries are a real staple. Daikon radish and turnips, you know, I'm just looking at here as a soil building crop. I spread them everywhere, and it's amazing what kind of yields you can get from those and how fast they can improve your land as a decompactor and a soil builder. Clover, you know, that's not a food crop, but it really is because it does so much for you, especially yellow blossom sweet and white clover. Let's see. You know, we experiment with...
Can we talk about a couple of those things you mentioned? Because
you worked my interest.
You said Siberian, was it teaberry?
Seaberry, like as in the ocean, yeah.
Oh, seaberry, like, So that's, they're the, I'll try to think of the other name for that, but I think I know what you're talking about there.
Sea buckthorn.
Okay, so that's a nitrogen fixer, and it does a lot of other cool things.
Yeah, fantastic plant. I mean, we've been working with it for about 5 or 6 years now, and basically if you give it a sunny site, it will do very well as long as it's not buried in the water table. I mean, if it's high and dry, it can be totally infertile. It's a nitrogen fixer, as you said, so it doesn't even want that much fertility. It's just fantastic, fast-growing, builds soil quickly, and then offers, not least of which, is a nutrient-dense, you know, really pharmaceutical-grade nutrient-dense berry, an orange berry that's loaded with essential fatty acids, vitamin E, vitamin C, you know, dozens of macro and micronutrients that is really, it really keeps us healthy. I mean, it's a health crop. And for us, that's becoming as big of a deal as growing our own calories, as growing our own nutrients. You know, being fed's one thing, staying healthy is another. So that's where the sea berry.
And it's like a massive, massive source of vitamin C as well in that.
Massive. But vitamin C, I feel like, is a little overrated. It's easy to come by vitamin C in a plant. You know, I mean, we always talk about oranges that have vitamin C. They don't have that much vitamin C. There's vitamin C in tons of plants and a lot of it. Seaberry has a lot. but more importantly, has fatty acids, which a lot of times we don't get from fruits. And, you know, it's basically very effective at improving the health of the soil and the land and improving the health of the human being very quickly. And it's interesting, a lot of the medicinal plants do both. They tend to be really great at degraded lands restoration and also, you know, health restoration.
Yeah, I think part of that is because, well, I mean, there's nitrogen fixation going on there with, you know, a lot of your leguminous plants would do as well. But a lot of plants that will grow in very infertile soil are very effective mineral and nutrient miners. So they're able to go deep, bring that stuff up from the deep subsoil, and make it bioavailable to the other plants. So if they're doing that, they're also bringing it into themselves, and then they're making it bioavailable to us. Another one you mentioned there, though, was a Korean cherry. Is that like basically like a Nanking bush cherry? Is that the same plant, or is it something different?
It's very similar. So it's a Prunus species, like you know, like a plum or a peach. And I'm blanking on which species of the Prunus genus it is, but it's a beautiful. People often plant it ornamentally. Korean bush cherry. It's like small sour cherry fruit. It yields just like a Montmorency type of cherry comes off it. But I've got these things growing in horrible clay subsoil at the base of stone walls, just with some mulch, and that's the extent of care they get. You know, without a dead leaf on them. Bearing heavily year after year. Just a fantastic nutrient source as well. It's not a nitrogen fixer, but it certainly does it in plants that don't have really any nitrogen to speak of. That one's been pretty successful.
Yeah, I'm going to cheat and make myself look smart here, but it's Prunus japonica that's from, and I only know that because Google told me.
Perfect. Another big important plant I have to mention is black locust.
Virginia
studioacacia. And it's easy to say it's actually not a food plant, but really it is because you can eat the blossoms and they're incredible. But it's just, you know, we want to make a shirt here, my friends and I, there's 101 uses of black locust because it's just such a gift of a plant. You know, fantastic soil builder, nitrogen fixer, most rot resistant wood we can grow at these latitudes. Maybe like Osage Orange, you could grow further down south where you are. Grows as fast as poplar and birch, but is as dense as white oak and hickory. So it's just a carbon machine and is great living fence, great building materials, you know, because it's so rot resistant and also so strong. So we're planting those by the hundreds. I've got maybe about 1,200 in now. We plant 300 to 400 every year. And I got the whole perimeter of my 10 acres planted in them every 12 to 18 inches as a living fence. Perpetual fuel wood source as well.
Yeah, because it coppices very well too. You can take some limbs off and it just grows right back, and it's
exactly.
A great firewood. I know for a fact from the fence building standpoint that there were farmers that I used to hunt their farms in Pennsylvania when I lived up your way, and you talked to them, and those fence posts have been sitting in the ground 50, 60, 70 years. You know, guys like my grandfather put that fence in, and we've replaced the wire twice, and the posts are still there.
Right. They say it outlives the cedar rails, you know, by a long shot, and the old Vermonters say it lasts one year less than granite around here. It's incredible stuff. I mean, and it's already illegal to plant in Massachusetts because of, you know, kind of accusations that it's just invasive. And I like to think of invasives really as plants that do really well without people. But, you know, that's another reason to add to the list of why to plant it. If they make it illegal to plant up here, you'll have witness.
It's already there. And once you get it going, it's self, it is invasive in their definition. And what that means is self-sustaining. Which, you know, God forbid we would have plants that are self-sustaining. I remember another, Mollisonian thing he said one time is I use 100% native plants. They're all native to planet Earth.
Exactly. And then, they're native now. They've always been,
And then Marjorie down in Austin on her backyard food production DVD, she says, as far as invasive goes, she says, if something invasive provides us food, provides animal forage, or fixes nitrogen, then please invade. You know, right. I mean, it's all a matter of harnessing it and using it. So
really look at that, and that's a big, big conversation, but we just, you know, just put out there, we really look at that like, what's the plant do, not where it's from, where is it from? You know, people have been moving plants for thousands of years. You know, everything we already ate today, unless it was basically a few berries, for the most part, not corn, not beans, not squash, not tomato, has all been, we've already been the beneficiaries of humans moving useful plants around the continents for thousands of years. And, you know, why stop that process when we can be conscious about it?
Yeah, the native plant purists, Mollison calls those eco-fascists, and he said we should make them eat only native plants and they would be dead in a day.
Yeah, foraging very thinly, that's for sure.
Yeah. Hey, you guys also, though, do teach PDC courses. Do you want to tell folks a little bit about that, like when the next time you have a course coming up is and
sure.
what a part, you know,
yeah.
what's your course like? What can they expect if they turn up there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the big difference with our course is it's really focused on skill building and immersion in a permaculture site. Surprisingly, there's still a lot of courses being taught that are, you know, kind of at a site without a lot of permaculture systems going on, and then they take field trips to permaculture sites at best. And we have a lot of field trips visiting of those courses that come visit us, and it's great, but they're here for 2-3 hours and they get a tip of the iceberg, and then they, you know, they go back to wherever the course is being taught. So our course really stresses, a 2-week course really stresses an understanding and kind of working literacy of all of the systems we've been working to develop, which are many. That's why we only started teaching our courses after developing the site for 7 years. Our first course was last year because we didn't have, you know, enough systems for people to really immerse in to offer what I thought would be a fantastic course. So, you know, from the rice paddies to the aquaculture ponds to the terraced and raised bed vegetable systems to the, you know, on contour swale mounds that we're working with in the perennial crops, to, you know, we have about 100+ species and varieties of fruits and nuts in the ground and a variety of animal systems. So immersion in all these systems really focus the course as much as we can within the 72-hour permaculture curriculum, which is actually really the challenge. And we may move to actually in the future not doing it be, not having it be a per PDC and having it be our own kind of 2-week intensive permaculture experience. We'll probably have it still be a PDC next year. The course next year is August 12th to the 24th, and we have about 2 hours set aside every day for skill building, too. So sharpening, you know, planes, chisels, side blades, you know, splitting wood, working with a grinder, working with a chainsaw, felling a tree, dealing with all the systems that you need to deal with on a homestead. You know, we think it can't be much of a permaculture course if you leave without having planted a tree or spread seed or, you know what goes into making a compost pile. So our course is quite different than some of the ones out there.
Well, sounds exciting. I might have to try to figure out how to schedule and get myself up there. When is your next course?
The next course is August 12th to the 24th. I guess it'd be 2012, next August. And if that fills, which it actually might, we'll have a course in July. Our last course this summer filled. But we rolled some people over from waiting list onto next year. So check out our website, which is wholesystemsdesign.com, has a whole page on our courses, and we offer a lot of other short courses as well.
Very, very cool, Ben. Hey, man, thanks for being with us today. I always get excited when I bring folks like you on the air, and we can talk about cool stuff instead of just the negative stuff that we're going to be probably facing going forward. I like to focus on solutions, and to me, when it comes to finding solutions for life, it seems like all roads end up leading back to permaculture because, well, if you want a solution for life, how about a permanent culture?
Absolutely. The possibilities are endless. We're just at the beginning of them, so it's very exciting. Thanks for having me, Jack.
Well, Ben, I'll tell you what. If you ever want to come back on, you just give me the subject, and we'll have you back on anytime. You seem like an awesome guy. I want folks to make sure they get by your site. Again, that is wholesystemsdesign.com. I will have a link in today's show notes, and hopefully some folks will link up with you after we do that for you, Ben.
Thank you. I've learned so much from your show. Keep up the great work.
Well, thanks again for being on the air, folks. With that, this has been Jack Spirico today along with Ben Falk, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.